We spent 14 months collecting information and lobbying for the creation of the commission, and another 20-plus months monitoring the commission's work, forwarding any and all research, making sure to send along our questions for the witnesses who were questioned, attending the hearings, making phone calls and lobbying for the extensions of time and money, sending thousands of emails, all in the hope that in the end, Americans could feel confident that we had indeed the definitive story of 9/11. Sadly, as Americans, we have all been let down. On the morning of 9/11, I lost my husband and best friend of almost 16 years. My two children, Matt and Sarah, lost their beloved father on that terrible day. And from that horrible day of September 11, 2000 forward, it has been made clear that in not allowing for truth and justice to prevail, America may have forever lost her way. For those who might question the reasoning and importance for reexamining the Commission's report, the events that led up to and the day of September 11th, one only has to recall the enormous ramifications that the attacks of September 11th have had on our country. Our leaders have, almost overnight, reformed government agencies and instituted innumerable laws in the interest of national security and are living in a post-9/11 era. Some, like the controversial Patriot Act, were forced through Congress without the benefit of congressional debate to determine its necessity and effectively find the proper balance between national security and our civil liberties. More lethally, our foreign policy has shifted to one of preemption, and thus we are at war in both Afghanistan and Iraq, where so many of our good men and women serving in the armed forces have lost their lives or have come home forever maimed. It is important to look back because in order for our leaders to make wise decisions about the changes we are instituting, we must understand what it was exactly that went wrong, that allowed our nation to become so vulnerable to terrorism, and we should not feel it improper to re-examine the investigations and decisions already made, especially in light of the fact that right after the 9/11 attacks, our leaders went full speed ahead with so many changes, most without the benefit of much of the information that has only recently been made available. Again, with lives on both sides of the equation, we cannot afford to be wrong or caught off guard either over there or here at home like we were on the morning of 9/11. Thus, only an honest reevaluation of how the 9/11 attacks could have happened will allow us to reverse the adverse consequences of overreaching laws and the existing loopholes in our security systems in order to allow us to be safer in the future.
That was Lori Van Auken, 9/11 widow and co-chair of September 11th Advocates, testifying on July 2nd in a briefing on Capitol Hill titled "The 9/11 Commission Report, 1 Year Later, A Citizen's Response. Did the Commission Get It Right?" Sponsored by Representative Cynthia McKinney of Georgia. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville. We return to the hearing with a Q&A from a panel of experts, Mike Rupert, author of Crossing the Rubicon, a book on 9/11 and its oil-based context, investigative journalist Wayne Madsen, formerly with the National Security Agency, and Ray McGovern, a former CIA analyst, now with Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity.
We're going to begin our questioning with Representative McKinney.
Thank you, and I have a ton of questions, but I think it's more important that I just make a statement, and that is how compelling and thoroughly researched your testimony has been today, how absolutely moving it was to hear your husband's voice, so that we have the opportunity to touch and feel as best we can a little bit of what you feel, what you must feel. And those feelings then compel you to ask questions, to seek answers, and you deserve to have those answers. I just want to thank you so much, the three of you, Lori, Mindy, and Monica, for being here with us today and enlightening us and sharing with us a little bit of your pain and of your patriotism to want the best out of your government, our government, and for the future of our country. Thank you very much.
We'll begin our questioning now. Mike Ruppert.
Okay, this is difficult for many of us and somewhat cathartic even all this time after the attacks. And I think I speak for many people in this room to express my gratitude to you, because it's apparent that you have not stopped digging even after the release of the Kane Commission report, and your positions seem to have changed a great deal since then. One of my biggest questions would be, you mentioned them in passing, the war game exercises, which we now know were taking place. There were five simultaneous exercises, and I think we'll hear from another presenter today, six, which in effect paralyzed NORAD response on the day of September the 11th. And you'd also gone to read the footnotes, and I want to comment that I saw Congressman Hamilton, who was the vice chair of the commission on C-SPAN, recently denigrating people who bothered to read the footnotes and point out the inconsistencies, but I thank you for doing that. There is one particular footnote that I will refer to very quickly in the Kane Commission report, which referred to the war game exercise Vigilant Guardian, and I think it's footnote 161. It's in my book. As an over-the-pole Russian exercise to practice for Russian bombers, when in fact the NORAD website indicates that the Russian over-the-pole exercise in progress that day was Northern Vigilance, not Vigilant Guardian, which we now know, thanks to USA Today and many other sources and on the record sources submitted to the commission, was a hijack drill. And we also have statements from Richard Clark in his book that there was another exercise in progress that day called Vigilant Warrior. And I have obtained an on-the-record statement from a NORAD officer indicating that that was a live-fly exercise. Have you looked into the issue of the war game exercises, and how important a question do you feel that is to answer? Because I also, and I'll shut up with this, you have gone past the point of you have deliberately stopped using the word mistakes, that there were a bunch of mistakes that occurred on 9/11, that it was all somehow a bunch of sequential accidents, and you made a deliberate statement about the FBI. Are you beginning to feel that there was some deliberate action that might have affected NORAD's response that day?
We waited a long time before we came out with, you know, criticism of the report, because it took a long time to read the report and the footnotes and wait for the monographs to come out. We didn't want to jump to any conclusions, so we gave everybody the benefit of the doubt for a very, very long time, which is why our language has shifted now that we see, you know, more of what was and wasn't in there. As far as the war games go, you know, we read Richard Clark's book also, and I think it's page 4 that talks about a different exercise that's not in the commission report, and it's something that has disturbed us also, because if you're talking about the definitive report of 9/11, everything that happened on the morning of 9/11 should be included, and it isn't. So it's you know, it's upsetting.
Our next questioner, Wayne Mattson.
Thank you. Lori, I was particularly interested in what you said about the United Flight 93, the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania, and the lack of any seismographic record of that impact. And I was wondering if you had had the chance or opportunity to speak to any of the people in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where the plane actually crashed, because many of them talk about the 8-mile debris field, which is not indicative of an impact by putting the plane into the ground. Also, they mention another aircraft seen in the area that day, that morning. And the other thing I'll add is, although we hear an awful lot right now from disgruntled people in many of the intelligence agencies, one we don't hear an awful lot from is the National Security Agency. And I had the chance to talk to someone who was on duty that morning at the National Security Operations Center, the NSOC, which is sort of the nerve center for all communications intercepts in the U.S. intelligence community. And this individual heard on the in the tactical communications area over the loudspeaker that morning two U.S. Air Force pilots over Pennsylvania stating, "We are engaging the target." And so this is the first indication out of NSA that there were U.S. Military aircraft in the area, and that they obviously did what Mr. Rumsfeld, he kind of messed up, and he said when they shot down the plane in Pennsylvania and then corrected himself. But I was wondering if you've heard any of this from the people in Shanksville or any other sources on the plane in Pennsylvania.
You know, we did not speak to anybody in Shanksville. Our bottom line was that we were hoping that that was the job of the commission, and that at the end of the day, when they released their report, there wouldn't be so many questions outstanding, either by us or other citizens, that you would have been able to read the report and felt that you had all those areas covered. And, you know, obviously it wasn't.
Thank you. Our last questioner, Ray McGovern, former CIA agent with VIPS, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity.
I would like to refer first to the remark made by Congresswoman McKinney, referring to Colin Powell's very mysterious promise that we would have a white paper. He made that promise a week or so after 9/11, and then 10 days later he said, "Oops, I misspoke. You're not going to have a paper, a white paper on this. You're going to have to depend on the press to figure out what happened." That's precisely what he said. I was always mystified by that. I said to myself first, well, they must not have much information. Well, I think that Laurie Van Ocken's testimony today, however brief it was, shows that there was a plethora of information. Indeed, the reason there's no white paper is because there was too much damning, too much incriminating information, too much. And I just would like to comment on the unusually smiling and greatly deferential attitude that the committee members and staff exhibit to you, the families, in public, and the way they have ignored your questions in private. And I'm just wondering how you feel, how you felt when you saw the final report come out, dismissing many of your questions, avoiding many of the others, and leaving, as you've already said, so many questions unanswered. What do you suppose lies behind that? Is it simply gross incompetence? Is it arrogance? Or is it something worse?
I don't know. And what I could tell you is that, unfortunately, first, we've learned to lower our expectations every time we go through another process. So when the final report came out, while we were hopeful, you know, it was just another disappointment. But we feel that we have to remain undeterred from those disappointments and just keep plugging along. It's not for us to determine motive or why. We need to make sure that the mission of making the nation safe is completed, and we will just keep plodding along until we feel that that has been accomplished.
I admire you all for hanging in there. Thank you.
Thank you all. We want to thank the panelists, and invite our second panel to move to the table, please.
Can we show them our appreciation for being here this morning?
This discussion will be Behind the 9/11 Commission, Flaws in the Process, a Staff Report, a Citizen's Critique. We're going to begin with John Judge, Staff and 9/11 Citizen's Watch. John?
We're running late, and I wanted to keep my comments short. But I think that it's in the best interest of everyone to take a second look at what we've been given as a final report of the National Commission on Terrorist Acts Upon the United States. It's being seen as an authoritative report, often by people that haven't taken the time to read it. It was hailed as a bipartisan consensus in the making, and a final word. And I think all day today you're going to see that it rarely meets that standard. It was followed by two monographs, and then a year later, one more. Although each of the nine investigative teams were working on a monograph, Representative Hamilton said that we will get no further monographs from those investigative teams. And it's interesting that the monographs that were released contained a page from Director Philip Zelikow of the commission, exempting them from the conclusions of the monograph, saying that the quote is, while the commissioners have been briefed on the work and have had the opportunity to review earlier drafts of some of this work, they have not approved this text, and it does not necessarily reflect their views. This seems to indicate that while there might have been a bipartisan consensus by the commissioners in this report, seems to reflect there might not have been a consensus between the investigative staff and the rest of the people on the commission. It was a commission that was beset with problems from the beginning, not only the obstruction in its creation, but underfunding that wasn't really effectively solved in a limited time period for political purposes. And even though they did a great deal of work, 2,000 interviews, collected documents, the report is essentially self-referential. The reason I say that is that almost 100 pages at the end of the report, in tiny print, have footnotes to interviews and documents and evidence, not a page of which, classified or unclassified, can be seen by the public. The National Security Archives recently did a Freedom of Information Act request for every single document listed in the footnotes from all the agencies involved, and every single request was denied. And denied in some cases on grounds that don't fit the legality. So basically you have a report where you're being asked to trust the investigators that what they saw in the evidence led them to their conclusions, and you don't need to verify it independently. But I don't think that's the way it should work in a democracy. They took some public testimony, but that testimony was marked by being primarily focused on the recommendations of the commission and its policy, not on the events of 9/11. And the majority of that testimony on the events was taken at the end of the long discussion about policy. In other words, they were making the policy recommendations before they found out what happened on 9/11. And the actual author of the report is still unstated, but I think in recent articles in the New Republic by Ernst May, we get an inkling, and also the release of the book Blind Spot, part of which was commissioned to be written by the 9/11 Commission by Timothy Naftali, that Naftali is at least the intellectual author of the report and its primary conclusion that this was an intelligence failure. And that's the focus of his book. Zelikow, the director, Ernst May, who also worked on the commission staff at the top level, and Naftali, who was commissioned to do that work, all three are part of the University of Virginia Miller Center on Public Affairs, a rather interesting institution that bears some scrutiny. And they have a long history together of scholarship at Yale and Harvard that interlinks with studies of U.S. intelligence and including contracted work with U.S. intelligence concerning covert operations. And I think that that's one of the main problems that exist when you create a national security state, is how do you investigate it without involving the people that are already part of that national security state. And this report reflects that in the choice that they made of the people that would be brought on to the staff. And I'm sure we'll be addressing some of that later, but they say it openly in Ernst May's article that was actually their priority, to get people that had been part of earlier covert operations. And yet at the same time, the report fails, as we'll see in testimony later today, to address the historical framework of the covert operations that seem to have led into 9/11. The missing white paper was mentioned, and it did show up in England. In the British press, they said that a white paper about the suspects and the evidence was given to them in order to get them to participate in the war in Afghanistan. And the quote in the British press was, "It's not enough to go to court, but it's enough to go to war." And so I'm not sure what the paper would show or what kind of evidence that is, but it isn't evidence that we ever got a chance to look at. This commission's report is not a rush to judgment. It's rather a rush to exoneration. And it fails to really hold people accountability and to accountability. And doing that, it doesn't make a witch hunt out of an investigation, but having standards of accountability, at least calling witnesses that might be accountable people in the events, would lead to a rigorous investigation and maybe getting at the truth, because people might be more forthcoming. In the beginning, the commission didn't even take testimony under oath. And Governor Keene, the director, told us that they thought people would be more forthcoming if they were not under oath. We found that a little counterintuitive. So I think that in addition to its own flawed assumptions and how it approached it, it also faced ongoing obstruction by the White House that refused to release documents, even refused to release the classified version of the joint Senate and House Intelligence Inquiry study that had been prepared by some of the people that sat on the 911 Commission and who had sat in on the classified testimony of that commission. And they did that consistently in terms of who would be testifying publicly and whether it would be under oath or not. There was very little transparency and very little accountability. They were exempt under the law from the Freedom of Information Act in their work, and they were exempt from the Family Advisory Committee Act, so that there couldn't be any formal advisory committee by the family members that were here, and no family member was part of the board. And by approaching the whole matter as an intelligence failure in the report, it obscured the evidence that what was normally a standard operating procedure in the period prior to 9/11 fell apart, apparently, in the months around and on that day. And it led to them pursuing leads and suspects, basically accepting earlier reports without doing further follow-up, blaming certain suspects, even though the evidence is that we don't yet clearly know who the suspects were that got onto the plane. And that's because several people have come forward saying that their identity was stolen, basically, by these people. So if we track that identity back in time, it doesn't tell us whether it's the person using it, a second person using it, or the original person involved. And it's only that evidence tracing those identities back in time, and primarily the testimony of three people that are still in protective custody that the commission could not interview. I'm talking about Ramzi Youssef, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Bin al-Shib, who are suspects or masterminds in the plot, never been brought to court. No one can question them. The commission was not even allowed to talk to their handlers or interrogators. All they could rely on were the printed statements taken from these people in custody. We don't know if the statements are accurate or real. We don't know if they were conditions of torture. We have no idea because there was no way to check it. And so we're left with a story that comes from people that we can't get to, and we're left with a story that perhaps is giving us the wrong direction in terms of how we're looking. But until we open up the report and until we can look at the actual evidence and compare it and begin to actually investigate further on many of the areas that the commission ignored, then we have a report that doesn't eventually serve the mandate that this commission was required to take care of looking at the truth of terrorist acts upon the United States. And it was acts, it was plural. And another terrorist act upon the United States the commission completely ignored was the anthrax incidents that followed about a month later and that have never been adequately investigated or brought forward. That investigation seems to have stopped at a point where they got to the gate of Fort Detrick, and then there hasn't been anything since. And this is going on years in the situation. So,
okay, John Judge. A member of Citizens Watch, we should say, an advocacy group that diligently monitor the government's actions, and currently a staff assistant with Representative McKinney's office. Mel Goodman is a professor of international security at the National War College and a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. From 1966 to 1986, he was a senior CIA Soviet analyst. And in 1991, he was one of three former CIA officials to testify before the Senate against the nomination of Robert Gates as director of Central Intelligence on the ground that he had slanted intelligence to suit policy. Mel Goodman.
Thank you very much. Two personal remarks first. One, I want to thank Congresswoman McKinney for what she is doing. This is an important examination of a 9/11 commission that was an historic opportunity that was missed in a 9/11 commission study that is terribly flawed. And I know that Congresswoman McKinney is perceived by many as to be contrarian. Well, I know how difficult it is to be a contrarian in the limited kinds of democracy we practice these days, and I hope one day her views will be considered conventional wisdom and not contrarian views. My other personal observation is I just left the government after 42 years of service, mainly with the CIA, but also the Department of Defense, the State Department, and the U.S. Army. That experience was important to me. I believe in public service, and I've always believed that institutions will prevail over the long run and truth will come out. And I think the 9/11 Commission has taught me that we need to be extremely rigorous and extremely tenacious in pursuing that truth because there's a corporate mentality in this country that's working against allowing the truth to surface, even in tragedies such as the 9/11 tragedy. This morning I'm going to talk about the flawed commission itself, and this afternoon I'm going to be talking about the flaws of the commission reforms, which for the most part are counterproductive and will ultimately do great harm to the intelligence community. But there is one piece of connecting tissue that I want to emphasize in my morning remarks and my afternoon remarks. And it's very simply this. The 9/11 tragedy, this terrible tragedy, was not due to oversight problems. It wasn't due to budgetary problems. It wasn't due to systemic or structural organizational problems. It wasn't due to organizational flaws. This is what the 9/11 Commission studied, and this is what they would have you believe. The 9/11 tragedy was due to personal failings. Institutions didn't make mistakes. People made mistakes. And the 9/11 Commission needed to observe the importance of accountability, and they didn't do this. And finally, and this is my real regret, the 9/11 tragedy was about bureaucratic cowardice at places such as the Pentagon and the Department of Defense, and this needed to be examined as well, and I hope eventually we can get into those areas. Now, let me say something about the commission. I want to talk about the commission itself, about the flawed process of the commission, and finally about the conflict of interest within the commission that is extremely important to understand the failure of the commission. Remember, there have only been three historic opportunities when we've had a chance to look at the intelligence community in this country. One was after Pearl Harbor. And that led to a series of investigations that not only provided very trenchant analysis of what went wrong, but provided an outline for the National Security Act of 1947, which really was the most far-reaching, important national security reform we've ever had in this country, because what the National Security Act of 47 did was to set up the national security community as we understand it today. The second opportunity was after a period of important CIA domestic abuses, and that was the Church Committee and the Pike Committee. The Church Committee and the Pike Committee came up with excellent reforms that unfortunately were observed in the breach. And if we had followed the wisdom, particularly of Senator Frank Church, the late Frank Church, we may have prevented the terrible tragedies that have taken place in the last 5 years in terms not only of 9/11, but using false intelligence to send Americans into war where they did not belong in Iraq. The third opportunity, unfortunately, was the 9/11 tragedy, which gave us this important opportunity to at least try to get the intelligence community, which spends over $40 billion a year, try to get this institution correct and to understand it and to see what reforms need to take place. And, of course, with the 9/11 Commission, this wasn't done at all. The 9/11 Commission had the broadest mandate of any commission in the history of the United States. With the exception of the Pearl Harbor Commission, there's probably been no more important national security commission. But in terms of broad mandate, the 9/11 Commission could have looked at any aspect of this tragedy, and it's regrettable that they didn't do that. Let me briefly look at the commission itself. What this country needed was an independent, nonpartisan commission. The commission wasn't nonpartisan. It was presented to us as bipartisan. Well, when you appoint a group of people, five Democrats and five Republicans, that is certainly not nonpartisan. And I would argue it isn't even bipartisan. What it is balanced partisanship. And you can look at the commission's report time and time again to see where the Democrats on the commission check the views of the Republicans and the Republicans on the commission check the views of the Democrats. So forget this notion that this was somehow a bipartisan commission. It wasn't. It was balanced partisanship, and it did a great deal of harm to the final product. Also, if you look at the makeup of the commission, here you have an insufficiency in the kinds of people who were picked to be on the commission. And I'm not going to look at the commission members one by one, but the fact of the matter is this is a group of people without any intelligence experience at all. This is not a group of people. Not one individual on this commission had ever received a president's daily briefing report, had never been involved as a consumer of intelligence, had very little understanding. And that was particularly true for one of the chairmen, the governor from New Jersey, who admitted he had no understanding of the intelligence community whatsoever. So there was insufficient stature, there was insufficient experience, there were insufficient knowledge of intelligence when this was totally relevant to what needed to be done. It would have been very easy to get a blue ribbon commission. You know, where were people such as Sam Nunn, William Perry, George Shultz, General Brent Scowcroft, Bill Bradley, David Boren, Gary Hart, even Warren Rudman, people who had served on the intelligence committees, who had studied the problem of intelligence and policy very closely, and may have had a contribution to make on the importance of change within the intelligence community. Now, let me look briefly at the process itself. The lack of stature may have contributed directly to the lack of rigor and the lack of tenacity within the commission. The previous speaker spoke eloquently about the subpoena power that was unused, virtually unused, maybe totally unused. This was a commission that deferred at every step of the way to executive privilege. They had a mandate where they did not have to defer to executive privilege. Take the point of view about the president's daily briefs. The entire commission was not allowed to examine the president's daily brief. Only four commissions got a look at some of the president's daily briefs. So no commission member came away with an idea of what did the CIA actually inform the White House about the problems of terrorism in the spring and summer of 2001. The commission also had the very good idea and correct idea that they should do their own debriefings of detainees. Now, we didn't know then, but we certainly know now how the CIA and the military used torture to gain testimony from these captives. But George Tenet told the co-chairman of the 9/11 commission that they could not have permission to debrief the detainees on their own, and the commissioners just faded away. They didn't pursue this matter. They didn't go to the mat with George Tenet on this one. And also the matter of allowing the president and the vice president to be debriefed together. This is obviously no way to run a commission. Now, in addition to the weakness in terms of rigor and tenacity, I think it's very important that the commission did not avail itself of the products that were out there, some completed, some nearing completion, some in important stages of the drafting process that would have been very useful to their own work. And the obvious document that they needed to have, that they made no attempt to take full use of, was the CIA Accountability Report. Now, not a lot is known about the CIA Accountability Report on 9/11, but this is the only report out there that actually gets into naming names, into dealing with those people who perform miserably in the period prior to 9/11. Remember, accountability is what is really one of the key issues that's at stake here. Find out who was involved. Find out if these people were rewarded for their work instead of punished, and see what accountability issues can allow you to make systemic changes within the intelligence community. Now, the irony of all of this is that the CIA Accountability Report was requested by a joint Senate-House inquiry from 2002, which was signed by the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Porter Goss. Well, who is now sitting on the CIA Accountability Report that was completed exactly a year ago actually in June 2004, none other than the director of Central Intelligence, who is now Porter Goss. But in addition to not looking at the CIA accountability report, the commission didn't take advantage of the excellent work being done by the Rob Silberman Commission on Weapons of Mass Destruction to show that there were no weapons of mass destruction, even though you had one of the co-chairmen, Governor Kane, who believed the Bush administration rationale for why we had to go into Iraq because of the so-called links between Iraq and al-Qaeda and so-called large stocks of weapons of mass destruction. They didn't avail themselves of the important work done by particularly the Democrats in the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, the work done on the Office of Special Plans that was preparing false intelligence for the Bush administration that refuted that could have been refuted in terms of the evidence that wasn't there for so-called links between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. And finally, a very important work that was done on intelligence reform was done by General Brent Scowcroft that was completed before the 9/11 Commission even began its work, and this work wasn't used. Finally, since I'm virtually out of time, let me just say one thing about conflict of interest. There were too many cases within the Commission by Commission members and staff members, particularly the staff director, Philip Zelikow, where people had to recuse themselves because of their own conflicts. I'm not in a position to get into all of the various conflicts, but the fact of the matter is this was known before these people were even appointed. And this should have been grounds, just as Henry Kissinger eventually had to resign as chairman of the 9/11 Commission because of his own conflicts of interest. They shouldn't have gone ahead to name those people who couldn't even take part in the serious work of trying to understand what happened on 9/11 and how do you reform the intelligence community. But the most important individual to me, other than a commissioner, was the staff director, Philip Zelikow. And his conflicts of interest were so great that you do have to wonder why this individual was appointed to head this important staff of over 80 people. He had very strong ties to the George Herbert Walker Bush administration, very strong personal and political and policy ties to Condoleezza Rice. But more importantly, Philip Zelikow was running the case study program at Harvard, which took millions of dollars from the Central Intelligence Agency over a 10-year period to write case studies on the CIA to establish a record that was essentially untrue with the facts about the work of the CIA. And, of course, the classic case study that Philip Zelikow chaired, along with Ernest May, who was his patron at the Harvard Kennedy School, was the case on the Soviet Union, how the CIA got it right, you know, the politics of getting it right. And, of course, as we all know, one of the greatest disasters of politicization of intelligence that occurred even before the Iraq War was over the politicization of intelligence on the Soviet Union. And who did Philip Zelikow bring in to the staff structure as a team leader on his staff? None other than Douglas McCacken, who was serving a tour up at the Harvard Kennedy School. And who was Douglas McCacken? Douglas McCacken was the head of the Soviet analysis shop during the 1980s, who was responsible for most of the politicization of intelligence. So here you have Philip Zelikow from Harvard and the case study program, and Douglas McCacken as a team leader on Zelikow's staff, making serious decisions about the need for change within the intelligence community. My last word is what this study is all about and what this process is all about is how do you regain integrity within the intelligence community and how do you regain integrity with an investigative process such as the 9/11 Commission? And ultimately, that's not about changing structure. It's not about changing systems. It's not about changing organizations. It's about appointing people to important positions who have the nerve and the courage to tell truth to power. And that's what's missing from our government at this particular juncture.
Thank you, Mel Goodman. We're going to move now to our question and answer period. Again, we will ask for one question. So let's reverse the order and begin with Representative McKinney, and then we'll go to Ray McGovern.
Thank you very much. Again, I have a comment, and that is, it seems to have to say the same thing over and over and over again. And that is, Washington, D.C. seems to be the only place where you can make repeated mistakes at the job, on the job, at the workplace, and get a promotion. Now, I don't understand that. The average person goes to work, they wake up every day, and if they're late 5 days, they get docked their pay at least, or they may even get fired. So my question to the panelists is, what does the fact that we have seen promotions instead of punishment for failure, what, if anything, does that tell us about the policy that these people who were promoted were carrying out?
Well, let me make one observation about that. We all know about the famous remarks George Tenet made to the president. That will be his epitaph, that if the president wanted intelligence on Iraq that would help him go to war, that would be, quote, a slam dunk, unquote. The CIA could get him any kind of intelligence he wanted, which is exactly what the CIA then did. George Tenet, when he left the government 6 months later, received the Presidential Freedom Award. When we finally get our hands on the CIA accountability report, and I think one day we will, and we find out the individuals who made the major errors, the major blunders, including people such as George Tenet, we're going to find a list of people who have been rewarded by the system. There's no doubt in my mind about that. I don't know it for a fact, but I can bet on it, because that's what happened during the 1980s. The people who had the worst track record on the intelligence on the Soviet Union were rewarded through the system, because the system wanted to paint the Soviet Union as 10 feet tall to justify Reagan's defense budgets that were at record levels for peacetime in the 1980s. The lesson from all of this, and it's a very serious lesson, is this kind of behavior, this kind of activity creates cynicism in a society. And it creates cynicism particularly among our young people. And when you have done that, when you have created cynicism and you turn people off to the important work of government and public policy and public service, you've really discredited yourself and you've really harmed the nation. And this is what I worry about.
Okay. Ray McGovern, did you have a question for our panelists?
The comments by Lori Van Auken on all the whistleblowers who were ignored, her litany of, she must have mentioned about 12 of them, I think just stands and speaks for itself. Sibel Edmonds, who was here just a minute ago, is sort of the arch example of that, testified for 2.5 hours. Not a word of her testimony appeared in the final 9/11 Commission report. I would like to turn again to the composition of the commission and ask Mr. Goodman about the two chairmen. We've talked a little bit about Governor Kaine, but nothing's been said about Lee Hamilton. Now, Lee has been, like many of the other commissioners, sort of anointed for the last year, virtually, well, almost canonized, I'd say beatified, you know. They've all been treated with great deference, and yet we hear from Laurie's very, very concise wrap-up this morning how they missed the ball on so many things. Lee Hamilton, in my memory, has a rather checkered career on commissions like this and in responsibilities such as this. I'm thinking Iran-Contra, for example. And I think that to evaluate his, quote, impartiality, end quote, one has to see or to take a look at how he functioned during Iran-Contra. Would any of you have any recollection of that?
Well, actually, I do, but here is where I beg to differ, and this is my personal disappointment with Lee Hamilton. Lee Hamilton did excellent work during the Iran-Contra investigations, and I remember when he made a series of statements. I was teaching at the National War College in the late 1980s, and I made them required reading for the 150 military officers who were at the National War College. And to me, pardon the expression, he was my great white hope on the 9/11 Commission, because you knew that Governor Kaine really had no background whatsoever to deal with this, and there were very political types like John Lehman, Slate Gordon really did not belong on that commission. He performed poorly as a member of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence in the 1990s. But Lee Hamilton understood these issues. So my real regret is, where was Lee Hamilton during all of this? My other problem with both the co-chairmen, Cain and Hamilton, is both said publicly, not in the report itself, that there was enough evidence that was accumulated, enough intelligence accumulated before 9/11 to prevent 9/11. Mm-hmm. Nowhere does the committee reach that conclusion. And actually, to be fair to some of the staff reports, there were 17 or 18 of them, and I'm very critical of the media community for not analyzing those staff reports. They were all on the Internet. All you had to do was go to the 9/11 Commission website and analyze them. The staff commission, or the staff studies of the commission, came closer to raising serious issues of accountability and blame than the final report did. So the final report, ultimately, is a cover-up. I don't know how else to describe the final report. And here, my great regret is Lee Hamilton didn't exercise the kind of stature he has as a man of integrity.
Mm-hmm. I would just note that at a public meeting where the family members were demanding that Philip Zelikow step down as a director, Governor Keene responded to their concerns by saying that he was aware and the commission was aware of the conflicts with Mr. Zelikow. In fact, he and one of the commissioners, Jamie Gorelick, had to testify to their own commission, and he said that Zelikow had recused himself at certain points in the investigation. And then he paused for a second, and he said, as all of us will have to recuse ourselves at some point. So that's the commission that's looking into it, a commission that every member of which has some conflict serious enough to recuse themselves. And but that's the dilemma, is how do you get somebody far enough outside the system to look inside the system or be allowed to?
In fact, our one of the family members, Bob McElvain, whose son, Bobby McElvain, an assistant VP of media relations at Merrill Lynch, who died on September 11th at the World Trade Center, would like to make a comment on that. We're joined on the dais by Mr. McElvain.
Yeah, Ray, you took some of my talk away when you mentioned Hamilton. But, John, I think you remember after the joint congressional investigation when the Blue Book came out, and David Peturti, I'm a member of September 11th Family for Peaceful Tomorrows, and we went to talk to Lee Hamilton. And I'll never forget this, and the Jersey girls were there, and David and I. And we were talking about the 28 didactic pages of the Blue Book, the first commission. And he said to us, he says, well, as much as I would like that information to come out to the public, because of national security, I just couldn't allow it. Now, I spend my whole life researching. That's all I do. I don't know if I'm going to be able to write a book or what, but going back to Iran-Contra, it was absolutely phenomenal. He practically made the exact same comment on the commission of the Iran-Contra. To me, there's a lot of people that should have been put in jail from that to the highest level. Yet he came out with that same statement, because of national security, we can't release certain information. And that bothers me. You know, that really angers me. But it's just, I just wanted to mention that.
Thank you, Bob. Our next questioner, Wayne Madsen.
Well, I'd like to keep this theme going because this was my question before your comments. It was on what we now know Mark Felt told Woodward, when you follow the money, you'll get at the root of all these scandalous operations. My question is, do you have a sense that when Bush first nominated Henry Kissinger to be the chairman, and then he stepped down because of conflicts of interest, and then they put Lee Hamilton on to take the place of George Mitchell, who also had conflicts of interest, that there was a conscious decision not to have this commission look into the money going back to the funding of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan? We could roll in BCCI, we could roll in Iran-Contra, and the fact that a wonderful former member of the House, chairman of the House Banking Committee, Henry Gonzalez, the late Henry Gonzalez, always expressed frustration that he got no cooperation from Lee Hamilton, the head of the House Intelligence Committee at the time. Or, I should add, also from the the person on the Senate Banking Committee that was looking into these issues, Senator John Kerry. He said he wasn't getting much help from. But so my question is, was we heard about the mysterious stock puts that when I went to one of the news conferences, Hamilton said, I reject the premise of your question, even though Governor Kane said it was still on the table to investigate that. I don't think it ever was. These were the stock puts on United Airlines, other stocks before 9/11. The fact that Paul O'Neill, the Treasury Secretary, had gone to the United Arab Emirates and been briefed on suspicious money movements through the UAE Central Bank in Dubai. To my knowledge, they didn't talk to him. Riggs Bank's involvement in the Bosnia Defense Fund, we know money bled into al-Qaeda units operating in the Balkans. Then, so with all this information, was this just a stacked deck against looking at what Mark Felt said to Woodward, follow the money, that they would not follow the money?
Well, I'd let John, I think, talk about the money issue. Let me just say one thing about the commission. The president didn't want the commission. The Senate Select Committee for Intelligence didn't want the commission. The House Committee on Intelligence did not want the commission. The first commissioner name was Henry Kissinger. Now, I have great respect in some ways for Henry Kissinger, but any of those who have read his memoirs know that this is not a person who looks for the truth from documentation. This is a person who uses documents to put the best face on an issue and really to sing the praises of Henry Kissinger. And I wrote an op-ed immediately after this appointment was made that this sort of gives away the game. There's no way they're going to get to the bottom of the 9/11 commission because they're going to appoint the kind of commission that just won't go there. So if you look at the people who were selected and the way they were balanced off, five Democrats against five Republicans, an inexperienced governor from New Jersey, and a former congressman from Indiana who apparently was not up to it or did not want to apply the rigor that was needed, and look at the commissioners themselves, I think they got the product they wanted, which is to stay away from personal involvement, accountability, bureaucratic cowardice, and particularly what the White House knew and when it knew it and how much information did it have. You know, one thing that comes out of the staff reports that doesn't come out of the commission report, if you compare the work the Clinton administration did before the Millennium Crisis and the spike in intelligence material and how active the administration was to gather together the intelligence community and to pursue every lead and to stay on top of this situation, then look at the next spike in intelligence reporting on terrorism, which was the spring of 2001, when nothing was done. Important positions went unfilled, particularly at the Pentagon. Rumsfeld didn't want to talk about terrorism because he wanted to deploy a national missile defense system in Alaska and California that doesn't work. And you had a national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice, who wasn't keeping the president up to date and wasn't checking on how the bureaucracy was performing on this very important matter of terrorism as Richard Clark was trying to communicate to her. So they got the report they wanted by appointing the commission that they felt they needed to appoint, which is classic for if you look at commissions in the history of Washington politics, that's how you, as you say, stack the deck.
I'll just say in the interest of time, you'll hear about the money and the other panels in great detail.
Okay. While we are in this segment on whistleblowers, we would be remiss if we did not acknowledge the presence of Sibel Edmonds, who has joined us here. If you could just... Sibel, many of you may know, is a former FBI translator who gained prominence when she went public with information that suggests that the U.S. was warned of the impending attacks using airplanes as missiles to attack buildings within the U.S. Thank you, Sibel. Our next questioner, go right to Mike Rupert.
Professor Goodman, you and I will forever and strenuously disagree about a couple of things, one of which is your statement that these were blunders and they were personal and not institutional. I I will go to my grave, and I believe my book documents an irrefutable case that the mistakes, quote unquote, made were deliberate, intentional, and they were both personal and systemic. That you made a brief reference to Pearl Harbor, and there's a book by, and I've butchered a couple of first names. I got the last names right today, but Stinnett, I believe his first name is Richard, Day of Deceit, with FOIA release of documents showing that we had broken the Japanese codes prior to Pearl Harbor, knew the attacks were going to take place, and allowed them to happen. I go further with respect to 9/11, arguing that we facilitated the attacks. We'll never agree on that. Wanted to say that. Perhaps we can agree on something. You talked about the deliberate slanting of intelligence, and I'm well familiar with DCI Gates, who was a DDI, I believe, under Bill Casey, Deputy Director of Intelligence. But from Richard Helms all the way through George Tenet, there have been allegations and records indicating that intelligence has been slanted for political purposes. I think we can agree on that. Looking at the 9/11 Commission, the Kane Commission, with these abundant conflicts of interest, I'm particularly taken aback within the last week seeing now this startling new evidence that Iran had something to do with 9/11 after seeing 20 to 40,000 Iraqi civilians killed in a what I think is a useless invasion of Iraq, the too many deaths of American service personnel. How, in your opinion, was the spin placed or the intelligence placed as a result of these conflicts of interest in the Kane Commission to produce a political result, and what political results have come as a result of the Kane Commission that were purely political?
Well, this afternoon I'm going to be talking about the reforms that stem directly from, I think, the ineptitude of the Commission, because these are reforms that will not help the intelligence process. Let me say one thing about the intelligence reforms. If you look at the reforms of the 9/11 Commission, would any of those reforms prevented the misuse of intelligence and the politicization of intelligence that were used to lead this country into war? Not one of them. If you look at the reforms, would one of those reforms prevent another act of terrorism? No, of course not. So this is what I worry about, and I share your concern there. My problem is I find that most charges of conspiracy from my 42 years of federal service are really dealing with problems that are what the British call cock-ups and not conspiracy. And I think serious mistakes were made. I don't think they were willful in the case of 9/11 any more than they were in the case of Pearl Harbor. But this is no time to be debating that.
And that was Mel Goodman, professor of international security studies at the National War College and a former CIA Soviet specialist, speaking on July 22nd at a Capitol Hill briefing sponsored by Representative Cynthia McKinney titled "The 9/11 Commission Report, 1 Year Later, A Citizen's Response, Did the Commission Get It Right?" What you heard was the first 2 hours of an 8-hour briefing with a variety of panelists. We will return to more of the briefing next week on the program. For more information and links to a variety of sites and resources on this topic, you can visit on the web www.911truth.org, 911truth.org, and you can contact us on the program or download archived copies of this and prior Unwelcome Guests episodes at www.unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.